Welcome to Globally Speaking, a podcast dedicated to unlocking global understanding. Join us as we engage with experts and innovators who are reshaping the way we connect with global audiences. Whether seeking to refine your approach, wanting to expand your understanding of AI and its role in transcending global communication barriers, or just curious about the intricacies of global content, this podcast promises to enlighten and inspire.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Series of Globally Speaking podcast. I'm Stuart Davison, Creative Director at RWS, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Michael Laveau, Head of Localization at Canva. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you very much, Stuart. It's a pleasure to be here speaking with you.
Can you share an overview of Canva and your role within the company? And I guess, how long have you been there? What are your key responsibilities in shaping its growth?
Yeah, absolutely. Canva is a simple drag and drop design tool. It's meant to make design accessible to everyone, including people all around the world. And my role at the company is making that product available in 190 international markets, along with a lot of other people working alongside me. I've been at Canva for 6 years, which is roughly half the existence of the company. And there's been a lot of change and lots of differences in responsibilities over that time. So very early on in the piece, my team was really the only ones thinking about international customers and how to make the product a better experience for them. And that's very much no longer the case. So today our job is really to work at the intersection of many teams focusing on international. Where we come into the picture is translation and simultaneous product launches in different markets and different languages, and also working on a lot of the creative. Canva is, after all, a creative company, so we focus a lot on the internationally appropriate creative that we're producing.
Cool. And in what ways has AI impacted the way we use human creativity?
That's a very topical question. Everyone's thinking about AI. I think it's put a massive magnifying glass over the top of human creativity. So just today on social media, I saw some people paying really careful attention to the use of specific words and phrases that they thought were markers of a post that was AI generated, which is really interesting because for me, I've spent my whole life analyzing language. So it's not that unique. In my experience, I studied literature and then linguistics, and it's been my whole life. But I don't usually see people outside of those spheres paying that close attention to the specific words that people are using. So that's quite a shift from my perspective. And in our own industry and in localization, I think there's a even more pronounced trend of people really starting to pay laser sharp focus to the nuances of language. So in the past, you could dismiss AI-generated content. And today you can't do that anymore because the AI translations that we have today, in many languages at least, they sound good. They're fluent. They are often creative. They often achieve that thing that was missing from AI translations in the past. So people inside my team, and I see people from other teams talking to us, and we're really trying to figure out what is it that is unique to human translation. What is it that humans bring to creativity in the scope of the realm of translation that makes it better? Because anecdotally and intuitively, we feel like there is an element of creativity, but it's not so easy to identify anymore in this new generation. So I think that AI is really sharpening our focus on what human creativity is and how it shows up in the various guises that we're trying to access it.
Yeah, it's also, from my perspective, it's very much an enabler as well for extending human creativity. Like it's an extra tool in the toolbox that you can sort of bring out. And some of the admin, if I'm looking at a tool like Canva, we would use Photoshop or whatever that is. Some of these AI tools that are integrated into that now take a lot of those admin out of it. So you can actually focus more on the creativity rather than the or trying to get to, you know, the end point of where you want to get to with your idea. So it's, and also it's the speed of it, right? Like when we started looking at some AI image generated LLMs earlier on about last year, you look at it going, yeah, you say it's all good. But now it's starting to increase so quickly that you actually find you're using it a little bit more just to get concepts out, or just if you want a quick idea to put into something, whether it's a social post or whatever that is, you can actually spin these things out quite quickly and transfer what's in your mind into this tool that can and build something quite rapidly for you to execute on.
That's the dream, right?
It's the dream, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Sorry, I'll just comment on that shortly if you don't mind, Stuart, because I think it's a really interesting point.
Yeah.
I think that's the dream, that we're removing that laborious kind of burden work from people's lives so that they can focus more on the truly creative parts of their work, and that it's becoming a tool that assists people to do that more efficiently. But I also think it is a double-edged sword, where we absolutely do see in my own work, I've seen places where we spend less time and money on lower value aspects of the work that we do, and then we do really, really interesting stuff in the other spaces. But at the same time, I think there are other spaces where we're seeing this compartmentalization of human creativity, where we're kind of taking everything that's interesting out of the task and turning it into a kind of mechanical thing that can just happen automatically very quickly. So I think that is to be lamented, and we need to be approaching this in a really deliberate way to make sure that we're doing it in the way that you described, where it is taking away the boring stuff and allowing us to invest more in the things that really matter.
That's right, yeah. Now, just going back to Canva quickly, actually, I've always meant to find out more about this, but Canva, from what I first heard, was actually set up by the owner so she could crop images. And when she was at university, right, she needed a tool to enable her to get her work done quicker. So I guess it's somewhat, you know, AI and Canva built off the same premise, is that it's an enabler for someone to achieve a high level of quality quickly and simply.
Absolutely. Emphasis on simply. The anecdote you're recalling there, Melanie, our CEO, was doing a degree in graphic design and was really struck by how much expertise you needed to even start to do a very simple task. And that was the genesis of Canva. How can you? So the first thing that they that Mel and her now husband Cliff focused in on was school yearbooks, which doesn't take a great degree of graphic design expertise to achieve, but nonetheless, you needed $1,000 software to be able to do it, and probably a year at a technical college or something to really be able to achieve it. So I think there is a really great alignment between what we're doing now with AI and the original vision of Canva.
Yeah, and it fits very nicely into companies. Like, we use it a lot within RWS. There's our core design team, which uses, as you said, the expensive tools that are out there and the complicated tools. And then there's Canva, that is our self-service tools, to enable people to create content quickly and on brand, which is really important for us. How has Canva adapted its approach to serving customers in response to evolving expectations over the past years? And within that, could you share any significant shifts you've observed in customer needs or behaviours, and the strategies Canva has implemented to stay aligned with these changes?
Yeah, it's interesting the way you phrase it. However, you responded to shifting needs in our customers, and I think we're not even there yet. I think the thing that's evolved is our understanding about customers, and we're still getting there. So I remember being in a meeting or a presentation probably 5 years ago, where they were displaying the results of a customer survey that someone had done. And they told us that the typical Canva user was a woman, and she was 30 to 40 years old, and she was using Canva to run a small business, which today wouldn't shock anyone, probably even people outside of Canva. But yeah, of course. But at the time, it was revolutionary, because it was the first time that we had an image of who our user was. Before that, we had no idea, or at least the rank and file like me didn't have an idea of who our user was. So we were like, oh, wow, okay. Now we actually understand what we're building this for and who it's for. And more recently, and from an international standpoint, we've learned far more about our customers, and particularly that they use Canva in really, really different ways to us as employees, which shouldn't be surprising at all, because at Canva, we use Canva for everything, and we're very particular people in very particular parts of the world. But we learned, for example, that some people are using Canva only on mobile, and they're creating, you know, 100-page presentations or incredibly complex social media graphics on tiny little 3-inch screens on their phones, which is something that we weren't familiar with and really required us to completely shift the way that we were viewing our product and who we were building our product for and how it was being used. So, yeah, I really think that before we even think about how our customers' use of the product is developing, we need to evolve our understanding of our customers, particularly once you refract that through the prism of 190 countries that we're in, so 190 or even more different perspectives of how to use the product and different restrictions and challenges and focuses.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you went from a desktop first approach to sort of then understanding your customers' needs and then adapting the product to suit or to help them with that, right? Because a lot of people were obviously building content on the go, or that's all they had. They had the mobile phone. So that's, you know, having it built for that environment ended up opening up almost an entire new market for you, which is like, you know, mobile first content creation, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And this happens dozens of times over where, you know, first we focused on international and we realized, oh, okay, customers in Germany have very different needs and expectations. And then we discovered mobile, and we discovered accessibility, and we discovered performance, and all these different dimensions come into it where you start fragmenting down this massive user base into individual personas who are all, you know, really quite unique. So it's just gets exponentially more complex as you mature your understanding of who your customers are.
Yeah, and dive into the data around the people who are using it. It's very interesting stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you have a localization strategy in place? If so, what types of content do you localize, and how do you determine priorities for localization? And could you share insights into your localization process, including workflows, tools, and other key elements?
Yeah, I hope we have a localization strategy. My boss might disagree or say that we don't have enough of a strategy, but I think we do. And really at the core of that strategy is this concept that we've developed over time of a critical surface. So surface is a very fluid term, and it basically can refer to any part of our product or the parts surrounding it. So for example, the login page of Canva is a surface. The editor in Canva where people actually do their design work is a surface. And what we've done is we've gone through the entire user experience and we've determined which parts, which surfaces within this journey are really critical to the success of a user, what allows them to get their job done. And obviously some surfaces are more critical than others. That editor that I mentioned is just absolutely fundamental. It must be there for people to be able to get their job done. There are other aspects that are perhaps more distant from the typical customer journey. Something deeply buried in our settings menu or a very particular help center article, something like that. So this is what we use to prioritize which surfaces are absolutely critical to the user journey. And that's where we really prioritize our efforts and investments, financial and resource investments. And the other areas are really where we're aiming for just accessibility, just being able to make that content accessible to international audiences rather than really prioritizing. And beyond that critical services approach, there are other lenses that we use. We have two big launch events each year. When I say we, I mean Canva as a business has two big launch events each year. Canva Create in April and Droptober in October. And our teams just focus an incredible amount of time on those two events, making sure that products are launching at parity wherever possible, and making sure that the campaigns surrounding these big launch events are available to our major markets. So these are really the tools that we use, the framework that we use to be able to prioritize those efforts. And you also asked about workflows and tools. There are almost too many to mention at this stage. It's a fairly mature process at this point. We've been localizing at Canva for longer than I've been there, about 7.5 years. And the number of tools and software integrations is just proliferated over time. It's too complex to describe at this point. I think that's the only description I can give.
Is there a prioritization for the languages that you localize in? Like, is there like a core set that you always do, and there's ones that you, I guess, wouldn't be as high a priority? Or do you consider, when you mentioned accessibility, that's the most important thing, so it needs to be accessible in all these 128 countries all the time?
Yeah, that's right. So Canberra is quite unusual for a company of our size in that we support 106 languages, which is huge scope of languages, and we have supported those languages since we had fewer than a million users, which is quite unusual. So yeah, it's a great challenge as a localization team. I'm not sure if I would recommend it to anyone who values their sanity, but that's the approach we've taken. And yeah, you're absolutely right. So internally, we have three different tiers of support. We talk about accessibility as being the most basic tier, where the challenge that we're trying to overcome is making that content available to speakers of that language. And then you take a step up, and we have a level above that we call trust. So it's really about driving trust and representation for speakers of that language or residents of a particular country. So that might mean, as well as the language, where we're really making sure that we're using the exactly the right terminology that's going to resonate for users in Argentina. So they don't get European Spanish or Castilian Spanish. They're getting the Spanish that they would expect in Argentina. And we're making sure that the other things surrounding their journey, the content, the features and everything, are really available at every step. And we have a third tier, the highest tier of support, that we call celebration, where we're really trying to celebrate the diversity of our customer base. And we do things like making sure that we're showcasing all the amazing content that the international content teams at Canberra have produced, to make sure that we're really representing the users in the experience that they're having of our product.
Yeah, that's awesome. As a creative director, within RWS, we always have to consider localization whenever we're creating content. How does Canvas support its users to create localized content? Or do you plan to do so in the future?
Yeah, it's actually something that we've done in various ways for a long time. So when I joined Canvas 6 years ago, we were in the midst of our first attempts to produce localized content. So at Canva, we talk about ingredients, which are things like fonts and photos and illustrations, all the little pieces that go into making or allowing people to make designs. When you think about it, the fonts that work for Latin script languages aren't going to work for Thai. They're not going to work for Japanese. They're not going to work for Arabic. So we had to go out and we needed to find these things. When you think about photos, well, there will be people in photos, and the people in photos are going to look different depending on which market you're in. And if you're trying to create a brochure in Indonesia, then you need people who look authentically Indonesian. And if you're making illustrations, well, then they need to use the right color schemas. They need to be, they need to feature people of the appropriate ethnicities and all these different things. So for a long time, Canva has been investing in acquiring and creating and otherwise finding these ingredients to be able to enable our users. But more recently, we've been focusing more specifically on enabling translation of designs, which was a pain point that my team had already identified by trying to translate Canva designs. And actually, through a little bit of research, I found, much to my dismay, there was a blog article on the internet where, if you searched Canva translation, the first thing that came up was this blog article, which was titled The Nightmare of Translating Canva Designs. So it was clear that we weren't the only ones that were feeling this pain. And over the last couple of years, we've released a couple of user-facing translation features at Canva, which is really exciting. It's quite unusual for localization teams, I think, to be involved in the creation of user-facing products. The first of those products was a simple AI tool for localizing designs. You click a button and it would reproduce the design in your chosen language. And since then, we've released integrations with translation management systems. So that's really a tool for professional localization teams or marketing teams who are doing things at scale. Your customers, Stuart, and we're building things for our own team as well. So there's a lot more to do. We want to provide more of those integrations, and we want to provide a much more complete user experience with you know, workflows for font selection and allowing that those functionalities to be more closely integrated with some of Canva's existing features like the brand kits and other things. But for now, these are the features that we've released that really are targeted at making the lives of localization teams a little bit easier.
Yeah, I guess it's a really important thing for creative tooling to sort of consider, because we've used a lot of other tools in past time to build, you know, really creative content. And where it falls down is when it comes to the localization, works really well in the English part, but then trying to transfer that into other languages is where it's fall down. It's a real shame, because content in itself, you know, most companies want it to be global. You know, they need it to go into these different areas, and really you should be able to create it once and then localize it, transcreate it and move it through, you know, to other areas, to other parts of the world for them to sort of engage with and connect with as well. So it's probably a real priority for a lot of, you know, creative content tools or creation tools.
Yeah, it's a surprising blind spot in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And it's you know, to be fair, in companies that I worked with before, like transcreation, localization was not really that much of a consideration. You used to just get a Word document and just, you know, copy and paste over the top of it. But really, there's much more nuance to that, which is really important to consider. Because what's right for one country is not right for the next one. You know, there needs to be that tailoring, that cultural connection to sort of, you know, maneuver and pivot it. So it's, you know, it's well received in the different countries. What factors do you consider critical when evaluating if you're meeting your customers' needs? And how do you measure the success of your localization initiatives in terms of customer engagement and market impact?
It's kind of a perennial question. I don't think I've ever had a conversation about localization where this one hasn't come up. How do you measure the impact? How do you think about the impact? And the answer for Canva is that we've tried everything. We've done user surveys, we've done A-B experiments, we've measured linguistic quality, we've done third-party audits, we've done localization scorecards for the business. We've done all of these things. And where we've settled in the end is we use some key metrics to identify where there might be opportunities. So to give you an example, we use some what we call guardrail metrics that we compare across different countries. One is 7-day retention, how many users are coming back and using the product again after 7 days. Obviously, there are a million different reasons why a user might or might not come back after 7 days. Localization is just one of them, maybe not even the major one. But what it does is, by comparing these things across country, it gives us a starting point. So if we see that users in France are not retaining as well as users in Germany or Indonesia or wherever it might be, that gives us a starting point to investigate. And maybe we find the problem is a localization problem, and maybe we find that it's not. That's still an interesting discovery. But this is the process that we follow in 2024 and 2025. We use these guardrail metrics, the data-driven approach to identify something that we should be curious about. And then we really dive in with a qualitative approach, whether that be asking out in market teams, whether it be using some of the tools that we have to gather customer feedback, looking at tickets that have been raised and things like this, or whether it means asking people to use the product and do a bit of a internal audit. So the actual metrics that we're using, the actual success metrics that we're using differ from part of the product to part of the product. We need to make it relevant to the actual function, the purpose of the different points in that funnel. But there's always this qualitative approach that follows up, because my experience is that the localization, the impact of localization is nearly always washed out by a million other factors. So you do need that human aspect to come in and figure out what actually is going on.
Okay. Why is understanding local customer journeys essential to effective localization? And how has the understanding informed Canva's localization strategies?
Yeah, so understanding the customer journeys is, of course, we don't know what to do if we don't understand our local customer journey. So our new head of Africa, the continent of Africa, it was so enlightening to hear someone who has lived in Africa their whole life and has been thinking about how to grow a product in Africa their whole life. And you kind of learn how ignorant you are in a lot of respects, even from the question of, well, which languages should we be prioritizing in Africa? It's not an easy question to answer. And that empathetic approach, that deep understanding of what a customer who might be very different to you, might have very different circumstances to you, what they actually need is really helpful. So often it's surprising. One of the outcomes of that conversation, which is somewhat counterintuitive and maybe not even a particularly welcome conclusion, is that the colonial languages dominate in Africa. English, Portuguese, French, those are far and above the languages of commerce and languages of the internet as well. So even though your intuition might be that you want to support the native languages, the local languages, understanding your customers will tell you how you can actually help them. And maybe you have to do both those things. But those learnings that you just wouldn't get from 20,000 kilometers away, in my case in Sydney, Australia, are just absolutely critical to knowing what to do.
How do you balance the need for rapid, large-scale localization with the demand for high-quality, cultural, nuanced content?
Yeah, it's a case of rationing, really. So we always have a limited amount of resources and a limited amount of time to devote. So that framework that I mentioned earlier around identifying those services or product that are really critical, that's how we determine where we're going to be taking a more or less scalable approach, where the less scalable approaches are usually the ones that allow for the most local nuance or true deep localization, what we at Canva sometimes call hyper-localization. So to give an example, the what we call the monetization services, the services where people are about to hand over their credit card details and pay for something. Those are the last things that users see before paying for a product. And sometimes those services, Canva's case, they generate billions of dollars in revenue a year. So you're making the wrong bet if you're trying to save a few dollars on the translation cost, because little small percentages of optimizations on services like that make a huge impact on the overall business. So we're in the business of deciding which places we really need to be having that laser focused attention to, and really overinvesting in some ways because the impact is just so outsized. And then the other places where the impact isn't so much there, and you're really just trying to achieve the base level of accessibility.
Mm, okay. And could you share a specific instance where Canva's localization strategy shifted from prioritizing scale to focusing on depth and meaningful engagement? And what was that impact?
Yeah, I can think of a couple. There's one that's kind of been happening over the course of years, and it's really more of a shifting company strategy more so than a shift in localization strategy. But early on in my Canva experience anyway, we were producing those templates and ingredients that I mentioned earlier. We were producing them via a translation workflow where we were taking these templates, we're translating them into other languages, and we're really leaving much of the rest as it was, which was great for scale. We were looking at numbers of millions of templates that we were trying to produce, and indeed did. But what you got was really a fairly surface level transformation of that content. Of course, since then we've matured that process, and we have a far more capability to produce better localized templates. But what we saw as an opportunity for the business was to engage more with the communities who were actually using this content and surface the work of the creators within those communities to our other customers. So by shifting our focus and our investment to empowering creators within those communities to take their content, to make sure that it's valuable by surfacing insights with those people about what sort of content was popular, and of course, incentivizing them with profit sharing around that content, we were able to actually have people in these markets who were Canva customers producing content that was of interest to their peers. So that was a real fundamental shift in the strategy, the content strategy that we had at Canva. And it took something that was designed for scale to something that was really designed for community, and that was designed exactly for depth and meaningful engagement. A slightly more quotidian example, something more confined to our team. We recently tuned our translation memory and fiddled those little knobs and buttons with our translation management system so that we were spending less on the more infrequently seen parts of our funnel. And we reinvested that same those savings that we had from twiddling those knobs and buttons. We reinvested that into the creative, the imagery that was on our landing pages, which are the first things that people see when they're visiting Canva. And we made sure that that creative was really showcasing the content that, for example, those creators and those localized templates programs had been producing. So it was really on their first visit, it was showing them that Canva was appropriate for people from their country and that there were that there was content available that was going to be appealing to them. So that was a case where we were very directly and deliberately reducing investment in one place to scale up in another place.
Okay. What do you envision the future of localization to be? What risks and opportunities stand out, especially in relation to customer engagement and emerging technologies? And are there any trending topics you find particularly exciting or challenging?
Yeah, I think the obvious place to start in a discussion about the future of localization is AI. And I think there are a few different directions that can go in. I'm usually a fairly optimistic person, but I think there are risks involved with AI. There are a lot of well-covered ones, but something that stands out to me is that AI is kind of in the business of taking human creativity out of localization. It's about reducing the amount, literally in most cases, about reducing the amount of human effort that goes into producing translations and localizations of different sorts. And I think there's a big risk that because that's the product that can be sold to localization teams, that we end up over-indexing on that as the value that localization teams can provide, when in fact the way things are going is that we need much more creativity, we need much more empathy, we need much more understanding in these areas of the business so that we are catering products to the customers who are actually using them. So what I hope to see in many ways is that localization teams cease to exist, not because people are out of jobs, but because we're seeing those functions merging with the other more familiar job titles in my case in software businesses. So instead of having localization managers whose skill sets are purely technical, we have growth managers and we have product managers who are focused on international. And as the technology becomes more accessible and less opaque, they're just becoming absorbed into the normal functions of a software business, where they're adding that human intelligence, that empathy, that local knowledge directly into the product delivery processes.
Yeah, we've started to use the term language specialists rather than the translators because the actual job role is evolving. And that specialism can be applied anywhere. And it's, as you said, it's that human connection that enables it to be tailored, tweaked, and meaning that anything that they touch can actually be more well received and connected with the humans we're selling to in terms of the products and the services and things like that. So I think there'll always be that part. It's probably more an evolution of the role around translation is probably going to somewhat change. And they're going to become more specialized. And once again, the tool becomes the enabler. And it takes away a lot of the stuff that would have been considered the job. But now it's the cultural knowledge. It's that in-depth consideration of the tailoring of the words and how that should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
What advice would you offer to fellow professionals in the industry and any key insights or best practices that have guided your success?
Yeah, I think the advice that I would give to anyone, particularly people earlier in their career, but at all stages, is to seek out your peers. And the reason for that is that I think I've had hundreds of conversations about localization, but you could categorize them into four conversations. There are only really four conversations that anyone has in localization, and they've all been had a million times. So everyone is thinking the same things. Everyone is confronted by the same challenges, and you can learn so much from having a conversation from people in the industry. And I know I reaped a lot of reward from doing that, which is a little bit atypical for me. I don't think my friends and family would describe me as an extrovert, but early in my career, I really did focus a lot of energy into going out and talking to people, seeking people out and asking them, hey, what do you think about this? And reading what people had to say about these challenges in the past. And it really accelerated, I think, my understanding of the industry, because there's just, it's really not that difficult of an industry. I think there's a lot of nuance to it, and it's certainly not an easy industry to master, but the actual challenges are relatively few, and they're fairly well understood, I think. Not easy to solve, but well understood. So speaking to people, you can really vastly accelerate your journey in understanding what to do and how to do it well.
Awesome. Thanks very much. Are you in Australia now?
I am, yes.
So this really is globally speaking, I guess. You know, I'm over this side and you're over there, so nailed it.
We've got both hemispheres covered.
Well, thanks very much anyway, and thanks for joining us on this Globally Speaking Creative Series. It's been a pleasure chatting to you. All the best.
Yeah, you're so welcome. It was great speaking to you too, Stuart. So next time.